This is Wes Cunningham on November 9th with Merv Obspin in his house off Cherokee Road. Merv, could you do me a little favor and just kind of tell me some general biographical information, where you were born, how you ended up in Louisville?
I was born in Opelousas, Louisiana. That's Opelousas. Opelousas is located in the southwestern part of the state, and it's where the Cajun and Creole complex is, where most of the people there speak a second language of French, Creole, and the food is different, and the accent is different, and the people are different. So I came out of that and went to college in Tuskegee, Alabama, at the Tuskegee Institute. Now, that college, historically, and this is back in the 50s when I came out of school in 1954, back in the day, that college was a major African-American institution that was founded by Booker T. Washington, and that Dr. George Washington Carver did much of his work at that university. And because it was located in the middle of the Black Belt in Alabama, it was able to draw some of the major African-American minds who came to speak to the students or to do teaching, to make available their books and what have you. So it wasn't a bad situation being there. Actually, it was my first time leaving home for any period of time, because all of the African-American intellectuals came. They spoke at chapel on Sunday. They spoke in classrooms. They brought their books down. And so it was really quite a learning period for a guy from Opelousas, Louisiana, who had recently moved to Louisville because my mother married a guy who lived in Louisville. And they moved up here. And I was going to college, planning to get into college at that time, so I went straight from high school to college. And when I finished college, I came back and settled in Louisville. But there were some interesting things that happened at the time I went to school, because somehow, as fate would have it, I came through college and high school and through growing up at a period when America was going through some significant changes that suggested that America would never be the same again. And I graduated from high school in 1954. I was at Tuskegee in 1954 through 1958. I was pretty young at the time. I got into college, I was 16 years old. I made 17 on my birthday, which was June the 30th. But it was an interesting experience because of the fact that I saw teachers that looked like me, guest speakers on campus that looked like me. There was a museum, the George Washington Carver Museum, right on campus, and I saw what this amazing man had done with lowly peanuts, you know, and all of the things he had discovered, and other interesting things that had happened to African Americans who were interested in going a step further. So that was quite an education, and I enjoyed it thoroughly. And then I came back here and was going to teach school. That was my plan. I had majored in industrial arts, and I was going to teach a shop class, which made sense to me, because the philosophy at Tuskegee was, you went to classes here, but you also learned a trade there. And that was an old Booker T. Washington philosophy. You learn to work with your heart, your head, and your hands. And so I took bricklaying. Now you can imagine, but I still got coins from that bricklaying. But anyway, it was a marvelous experience. And to meet people from all over the country and from all over the world, because Tuskegee had such a reputation that it attracted students from India, from the Far East, from Africa. So we had a mandatory church service every Sunday. And that meant you had to dress up, and you actually literally marched to church from one of the dorms all the way to the chapel. The chapel was a very famous chapel because it had what was called the singing windows, which were windows that depicted the African-American spirituals. And so they called them the singing windows. You got dressed every day, every Sunday to march. And if you were in the ROTC, you had to wear your uniform. And if you were in the Army one, you wore your Army. I was in the Air Force, I had to wear my Air Force uniform. And we marched, and they marched us right in there and set us on one side and the girls on the other side. But the interesting thing was that our students from other countries also marched with us, and they wore the outfits that were indicative from their countries. So it was like a little United Nations. And it was just a fabulous experience because you would see all this color and all this diversity. Tuskegee at the time had one of the finest schools of veterinary medicine in the country. And that attracted students from all over the world. So you always had that group of students from elsewhere. It was quite an experience. I had them all. I really did. And when I got to Louisville, I was ready to start teaching. Well, my stint teaching, there was an opening at a middle school called Duval Junior High School. And I took it. It was a shop class. I said, I don't know a single thing about shop. So I would take the books home and make the projects. And then get to school next morning and we'd try them out. And that's the way I survived until I got involved with some people who were involved in the local civil rights movement. I do apologize.
Oh, you're fine.
One of my close friends was a young man named Frank Stanley Jr., whose father was the editor of the Louisville Defender, which was the local black weekly. And with Frank, it was determined that he had to participate in the local civil rights movement. As a matter of fact, as young as he was one of the leaders. And so next thing I know, he's got me on 4th Street, marching with a sign, picket sign, demanding that blacks be allowed to try on clothes. You know, when I got here in the 50s, you could buy a suit from a store on 4th Street, but you couldn't try it on. And we were making that demand, and the merchants were not really suggesting that it would bother them whatsoever. And so we decided, okay, let's go to their pocketbook. And we decided that year, nothing new for Easter, which became a rallying cry in the black community. Well, as you well know, blacks and others always go to the store Friday East because that's when they buy their kids nice little new outfits. And when we decided nothing new for Easter, we got their attention. And it was kind of interesting because a couple of stores quickly let us know that our dollars were welcome. One of the stores I remember quite well was Bick's. The Bick family, Mrs. Bick, became a very close personal friend because she supported everything we did. And other stores followed her, stores like Kaufman's, which was right on the corner of Chestnut and 4th Street. And so you didn't have a solid wall against it. You had people who said, wait a minute, this doesn't make any sense, you know. But it was an interesting experience, and we saw firsthand how the civil rights movement could change things. And So that was a hell of an experience. Meanwhile, I'm teaching school, and I know that the superintendent of schools is not going to be happy to see me being arrested. And as a matter of fact, I'm sitting in front of one of the stores at Chestnut and 4th Street, and who walks across us but the superintendent who was overseeing the people who taught shop. And I said, oh my God. And he wasn't too happy to see me. And so, but I got out of there in time. And next thing you know, I went to work for the, there was a group of artists, black artists, and we were having real problems. We were doing art, but we had no place to show it because all of the art galleries in the city were owned by whites, and nobody wanted to break the tradition. And so we showed wherever we could. We showed in restaurants, we showed in bars. Anybody who would give us space, we showed in church. And wherever they let us hang, we'd have a show. As a matter of fact, we may have had the first show in Central Park because nobody would show us, so we went to Central Park and we hung up clotheslines and we hung our paintings and we had a 2-day event. Now, the big thing is Art in the Park, but I can assure you we were there before it even started, so it may have been an idea that was carried from there. But it was a great time to meet other artists and to meet people who were interested in art. And while I was doing that, the woman who reviewed our shows, because we ended up buying a storefront, I guess Bob told you about it, that we named it the Louisville Art Workshop. And we had the storefront, and a friend of ours named Fred Bond, who was also an artist, he and his wife lived in the rear of it. So they carried the major responsibility because it was a house for them. And we would have our own shows, and it was fabulous because we had G.C. Cox, Bob Douglas, we had Sam Gilliam, we had old Bob Thompson, we had all of the black artists were participating in this, and it was a fruitful time because we would take it and we would pool our money and hire a model. And then everybody would be sitting at their stations doing the model. And it was just a fabulous time because when you finish something, you had people to show it to who could give you feedback and who would come to you to get feedback for what they were doing. And so you had this interaction going and you just felt real good about it. It was about that time that a woman named Sarah Lansdale, who was the art critic for the Courier-Journal, and she would come to our shows and she wrote about them, and I've got her clips in the back in a folder if you need to look at them. And she talked about the black art movement locally and what have you. She's a really sweetheart. She told me one day, she said, Merv, there's a job at the Courier-Journal, because that's who she worked for, in the art department. Why don't you go up there and talk to those folks? They'd be delighted to hire you if you talk to them. I said, oh, sir, I have no special training in art. I'm self-taught. She said, I don't care. If you go up there and talk to them, you'll see if you like what they're doing, and they'll see if they like what you can do. Well, she kept pushing me, so I went up there. And I met the art director, and his name was Louis Day, I'll never forget it. And Louis said, well, you don't have a degree in art, blah, blah, blah. Well, what he didn't say was there was not one single artist of the seven he had working that had a degree in art. But he was going to use that time, that same old way to keep me out of it. I would let him go. We talked for hours. Finally, I told him, I said, look, I'll make you a deal. I'll work here for 2 weeks at no pay. You will see if I can do what these people are doing, and I'll see if I like doing it. Because all I needed to do, I've been innovative all my life, is look over somebody's shoulder and see what they're doing. I noticed they were using airbrushes, you know, to soothe out the background, what have you. And they were using water-based paints because everything was in black and white for the most part. Excuse me, they were able to take a whole tree out of the background, a horse. And I said, oh, yeah, I can do that. Well, he said, okay, reluctantly, we'll give it a try. And so I went and I introduced myself to all the other artists. And I sat at their desk and watched how they were doing it. And I said, one way to do it. Well, when I had been in the Army, and because I had a background in architectural drawing from Tuskegee, what I ended up doing while I was in the service, for the 2 years that I spent in the service, was map topography. I knew how to draw maps. And what they would do is sometimes they would take me up in a helicopter down to Fort Knox, and I would have to map out where the movements were and where they were training, you know, and I could do that pretty good. I discovered that all of the guys in the art department, the one thing they hated doing was maps. A teacher who was a nun, a black nun, who taught me years before, when I was still in Louisiana, had always told me, Merv, you can survive if you develop a talent and do it better than anybody else. It occurred to me, these people hate drawing maps, and I know how to draw them, I can make this my bailiwick. So every time an editor came in and said, look, there's been a major accident at 4th and Walnut. I need a map to show exactly where it was. Or there was a train wreck down at so-and-so, and I would sit there and get that map on out. It got to the point where they would come and look for me, and I said, well, now, Merv, how can you make this easier? So, because the newspaper is divided into columns, I made base maps of Louisville, Jefferson County, Kentucky, and the United States, all 4 column sizes. So if they needed a 1 column, I had it already done, a 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, half a page. And all I needed to do was just have the print. I could cut it out and just stick it right on the map because I had all the main streets and highways. I began to set me up a whole system where they would come in, and if you had all the major roads, you had Broadway, you had Chestnut, you had I-65, all you had to do was just cut out and just stick the new place I was talking about. And that worked wonders, you know, and I had them all, because I could put their maps out so quick to make your head swoop, and they would come and try to find me. And that worked out fine. And the more that happened, the more relaxed I got in the situation because I found something I did better than anybody else. Next thing you know, they decided to send me to a rally that was being held at Greenwood Avenue and 28th Street. And that's the one that got really ugly. I told them, I said, they're going to have a rally down there. You need to send a reporter down. And they said, well, Merv, yeah, we're going to send a reporter. Would you go with the reporter? I said, you want me to protect him? He said, yes. And I said, well, okay, well, I wanted to see what was happening anyway. And so the reporter and I went down there. And maybe it didn't take long before I looked up and folks were turning over cars and breaking windows in the little shopping area there. And I said, oh my gracious, I got to get this reporter back to the paper. And I found a guy who I knew that I had taught in middle school, riding around an old beat up Cadillac. I said, well, you take this man back to the Courier Journal for sure. Took him, and I called the Courier Journal and I said, I will stay here and I will tell you on the phone what's happening, and you have some people in there to write it. And I stayed there 48 hours. And it got ugly. Two people were killed in those riots and thousands of dollars of damage. But I had people I knew from teaching who were out on the street, and from the civil rights movement who was out on the street trying to get everything under control. So I was cool, and I was the man calling in. And when it was over with, they didn't even give me a byline. But the owners of the paper said, wait a minute. And this was the Binghams, who was a family that owned the Courier. Said, Merv could be of much more use to us as a journalist than as a artist, because we have nobody in our newsroom that looks like him. And if this is an indication there's going to be some other things happening down the road, we need somebody. And so they decided to send me to Columbia University in New York for special training, because this was the time right after King had been killed where other newspapers in Philadelphia and in New York and Washington and New Orleans, Miami, were re-evaluating their staffs, which were traditionally all white. They had set up a special program at Columbia University in New York, funded by the newspapers and the Ford Foundation, to train people like me to be journalists quickly. And so the Courier Journal says, you're going to New York, and you'll be up there for 4 months. And I said, okay. Told my wife at the time, I said, but I got a wife and a toddler. He said, don't worry, we will make sure your check is in the mail every week, and we'll send you a stipend to live on. Well, man, I got to New York, and my neck hurt from looking at the buildings. First time I've ever been on an airplane, I tell you. So many people knew I was going until when I went to the airport. 25 plus people who were friends of mine that worked with me were at the airport to see me off. It was going to be a special thing because there was then now going to be a black voice at the newspaper. And all these people were not black. These were whites I knew and people that I knew. I got to New York and I had a ball because the way that program was set up, they brought some of Walter Cronkite's, Howard K. Smith. They brought some of the big names to Columbia to talk to us, to teach us as quickly as possible how to get the news done. And man, were those interesting times. And one of my dear friends, Bob Maynard, who ended up owning the Oakland Tribune and his past, was the head of that program. And Bob made sure that I was involved in everything he could get me involved in. And it was just fabulous because we were putting out a newspaper. It was 12 of us that other newspapers had sent. And we put out a weekly newspaper, and they sent us out on assignments. And they had people that they had borrowed from other major newspapers who act as editors and typesetters, the whole bit. And I would come in and Bob would just give me a little sheet of paper and he said, this is 2123 Fifth Street. There's a meeting going on, you need to check it out. I said, well, what is the meeting? Well, I'm not telling you, you go find out. So I'd get me a coin and get on somewhere, and away I go. I learned New York backwards and frontwards. That's something, but it was a great experience. And when it was over, and I came back here, and I felt like I could do the job. Well, next thing you know, they promoted me because the newsroom was still all white. They said, well, now, Merv, you've met a lot of people. And and I said, yes, I have. They said, well, I do apologize.
Oh, it's, I know what it's like.
God, this has been a mess. Anyway, they used me. Next thing you know, I got promoted because they said, well, we need to promote him. And they asked me to be the recruiter to see if I could find some other African Americans and others to put on the staff. I had gotten involved with a newly formed organization called the National Association of Black Journalists. I later became president of that national group and raised the membership numbers from slightly over 300 to over 1,000. It became the end thing because black journalists that had gotten into these newspapers all over the country saw this as a way to come together and exchange ideas. We were rolling. They were having a ball. And I enjoyed it thoroughly. They promoted me to associate editor for development. It was a new title. Nobody else had the title. Man said, we want to promote you. What do you suggest? I said, well, you can make me assistant managing editor. You can make me associate editor for anything you want to. And he said, well, let's go with associate editor. I said, well, fine. I'll name my own job. And it was a ball. I enjoyed myself thoroughly at the local paper because you could see the results of your efforts when you picked up the paper. And since I was out recruiting, I said, I'm not going to go out here and just recruit minorities. No, I'm not going to be your recruiter unless you allow me to use the same standards and recruit anybody I see that would be a good fit. I said, well, that makes sense to us. Now we're cooking. I am now associate editor / development and chief recruiter. Now we got it. And there's nothing that says black or white or green or purple. And so I had more because I had to be involved with all the major editors' organizations because I'd go to their conferences, and because they may be an associate editor, I could belong to their organizations, and then I'd have to go to the National Association of Black Journalists Conference, the Hispanic Groups Conference, the Asian Groups Conference, looking for people that I could connect by, and caught on and said, wait a minute, you don't need to, they had just bought the Courier Journal, the Gannett Company. You don't need to just recruit for Louisville, you recruit for Gannett. If you see somebody, you let us know, we'll go get them. So that was a good deal. And I stayed there until I retired. And well, at the same time, I know I'm driving you crazy, but.
No, not at all.
At the same time, I met a young man named Jabril Diallo. And Jabril was from Senegal. He was a beautiful dude. He wore his long boobas with his fancy caps. He had two PhDs, one from the University of London and the other from one of the universities in Paris. He spoke 12 languages, and we became bosom friends. And I was president of the National Association of Black Journalists at the time, and Jabril said, Murph, I'm going to open some doors for you where you're going to go where you never dreamed of it. And he did. He took me to Timbuktu twice. It actually exists, but I got the pictures to prove it. He took me all over Africa. He sent me all over Latin America and Central America. And what an experience it was, because I was meeting heads of state. You know, I met in Africa alone 8 heads of state. And they were very comfortable with me because they wanted the media to tell their stories, because they could look for help from Europe and from the United States. And that was an experience. Man, we went through the desert, we went through the jungles, went everywhere. And here's little old Merv right there in the middle of it. I tell you, it was quite a trip. And so, when I finally retired, I felt good. I had made good contacts. I had enhanced my collection of African art, as you can see. And it was just an experience, seeing new things and meeting new things. And the more you saw new, and the more you went to new places, the more you saw how people with less resources than you were able to make ends meet. You know, and so I didn't complain as much as I used to about what was happening in the United States. I went and I saw people, you know, who were barely eating, and they took care of each other, and they were innovative, and it was cool, you know. And so you just began to get another view of the United States and of the world. What else can I tell you?
I'm actually, let's jump back a little bit and focus a little more on art. Where did you first get involved in art? Where did you first get interested in art?
When I first got to Louisville to teach, I didn't know many people. And I met a couple of artists, one named Bob Douglas, who you've already interviewed, the other one named Ed Bond, who is deceased. And they were involved in coming together. They were coming together in Bob's basement. I have pictures of us in Bob's basement. And we would talk about art and what have you. And that's when I began to get really involved, because I had somebody to show my work to. Okay? It was not an overnight thing, but if you got somebody to show your work to, people like J.C. Cox, I'm sure Bob mentioned him when he talked. Mr. Cox was older, old enough to be our fathers, but took so much time with us. When we would talk to G.C., G.C. would take time and say, "Now, Murray, this is the correct way to stretch a canvas." He'd show me. I still got the pliers and stuff that we used to do it. And he'd say, "Now, this is what you should do. When you prime that canvas, it has to be so tight, drop a quarter on it, it'll bounce back up." Okay. And he taught us. Meanwhile, I had just gotten a job at the B.F. Goodrich plant down in the West End, because they weren't paying teachers anything. And a group of us who were involved in civil rights had begun negotiating with them about hiring some African Americans. After all, they had a plant right down there in the West End and no African Americans other than the ones with the broom. They did, and when I found out what they were going to pay, I said, "Hell, I'll take one of those jobs too." Well, the end product was these people made plastics. They were little plastic chips that were remelted to make radio cases and make plastic products. But in order to get the plastic products, they had to make these little beads, and they had to dye them very, very careful, because they had to have a formula so that the colors all matched. And they used raw pigments to get the colors going. They would put these things in vats that were high as this, and about this size and all the way up. They would mix it, and then they would put the color in, and they would mix it, and they would pour that out. And then somebody had to get in these big tanks that looked like mixmasters and clean them out. And I said, wait a minute. I would find sometimes they'd have a contaminated bunch of raw pigments. Man says, yeah, you can have them. I'd take my little lunch bag and fill them up, take them home. I got home and I mixed them with linseed oil, and I had fine paints, just like you get out of a tube. And so that became wonderful. That would allow me time to do it, and at hardly no cost. And I just had a ball with that, and I passed it on to my friends and them. But I just taught myself as you went. I just learned a long time ago that you have to be innovative in order to survive. And if you didn't have a trade, you should find one, find something you do better than anybody else. And I can mix those paints, and if you didn't like it, I could still tell you I liked it. See, that's one of my pieces.
Beautiful.
That's one of my pieces. 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 Majority of those pieces in here. And you just went with what made you feel good.
What was, when you found, how did you get in touch with the Louisville Art Workshop? And
we found it.
Yeah, how did you all come to find a place all together?
Fred Byrne, who was one of our members, was a fine potter, needed a place to stay. He was living in a house that I thought was dangerous. It was not in good shape. And he had three children. And so he was looking for a place. And then we found a place with space in the front and living quarters in the back, which was perfect for him. And so we made a deal where he bought the place and we would help him on any shows and stuff we had. And if people made donations, we'd throw it at Fred, you know. And that's how we ended up with the Art Workshop.
And how was it received in the Louisville art community as a whole?
Well, much of the white community act like we weren't there, but we had others, especially some university people from U of L, and we had Sarah Lansdale, our art critic friend, and so they couldn't act like we didn't exist. We then threw a show for George Joseph, who was an editorial cartoonist for the Courier Journal. And he wasn't African American, but we gave him a show. Brought new people in. And people began to support us a little more. It was never a great scene, but somehow artists survived. You know, we always suffering, but we survived. And other artists would come into town, and they would look us up. Artists who would be stationed at Fort Knox, who worked making maps and stuff for the Army, would find us because they'd be looking for an outlet in the city. and they would come and they would show with us too. So we got a lot of people involved. People began to know who we were. It was cool.
And how did your all's art engage topics like race?
Same way most art does. Some artists, like Bob, painted figures in racially sensitive situations. That was, I don't know if he showed you his work, but I, on the other hand, like to do abstracts. But the art I did that was realist was in a more positive form. I'm a jazz fanatic. Love jazz. And so, I'll show you, there's a picture in there of a jazz player, bass player. I painted that. Oh, shit. I painted pictures that were more positive look. You know, if everybody's crying the blues, sooner or later, your audience is going to stop listening. And so, I painted musicians, come let me show you. Because that was a very positive thing, how you know? Now, do you need a bio or anything?
Do what?
So do you need a bio or you can get it offline?
Yeah, I can get most of the stuff offline. Just how did the art scene, you and your friends in the workshop, how did you all engage the black freedom struggle that was going on?
Much of the art we did were statements that related to the black freedom struggle, you know, and whether they be abstract or realistic, abstract the name, you know, see that one?
Mm-hmm.
I'm on a river and it's going nowhere. See what I did with the river?
Mm-hmm.
That makes a statement about race relations in America. So, see, you can do an abstract and the name itself, or you can do something like this that Bob did, and you can name it and it's obvious. When I worked on the musicians' pieces, I knew that music, especially jazz and blues, went across racial lines. And so what it did was, it suggested that at least in these areas, we don't have a problem. They may not get as much credit as they should get, but musicians always welcome musicians regardless of what color they are. When I think about musicians like Jerry Mulligan, Chet Baker, and others, when they get together and play with Thelonious Monk, Miles Davis, I don't look at no color. These are people who play as well as. And so you've got it going, and nobody really pays that much attention to it. Unless you're doing, you know. And so, that's one of the things I liked about jazz. It's always been room on the stage for you. And so, music says something to me, and that's one of the reasons I like to paint jazz musicians. You know, I mean, that picture of the bass player, for instance, it's just a great bass player. You know, you can feel him. And that's kind of the way I feel about that, using jazz to make a statement about race relations in America.
And what was your take on the role of arts and culture in the Black freedom struggle? Like, what role did you see it playing?
Well, I thought it played a significant role because it gave intellectuals a platform to write, gave artists a platform to do art, gave musicians a platform to play. And during the Civil Rights Movement, all of those things became our way of stating our purpose on how we wanted America to look and to be. So it played a significant role. I mean, very significant role. Have you ever heard Louis Armstrong saying, "What a wonderful day"?
Mm-hmm.
That song almost brings me to tears, because what it suggests is how things could be. And it was written while he was still down in New Orleans, my neck of the woods. There are songs all through the movement that became significant, much like painting became significant. One of the great shots, it's a shot of Angela Davis with her fist up. The woman who did that, I've got one of the pieces. I knew her. And I've got one of the pieces that she did. But sometimes something will come out of it, come out of the movement, and it becomes an icon of what the movement was all about. Am I making sense?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And so, art, there are certain artists who were able to depict it and give it feelings just like it was. And I didn't want to compete with them. Those artists are much better than I would ever be. They've been doing it for years. You know, some of the older African-American artists have been Jacob Lawrence and others have been making these statements on race long before it was in vogue. And their statements are still quite powerful. So, sometimes when I feel a little beside myself, I get in that book and see what people brought to the table and how it changed America. I must say I was surprised to find me in that book too.
Which one?
The Kentucky Encyclopedia.
Oh yeah. It just recently came out.
Yeah. I didn't know I was in it. Nobody interviewed me before. It's cool.
How did you see your work and the work of your friends in the Louisville Art Workshop and so forth? How did you see your all's work interacting with the larger national Black arts movement?
Well, you know, I'll tell you the way I feel. We didn't have too much time to study what everybody else was doing because there wasn't much publicized about what people were doing in New York or Washington or Detroit. If you lived in those areas, you had access to it. You know, we knew that Sam Gilliam was on the upcoming, was going to be a major artist. We knew him when. We knew that Bob Thompson would become an icon because he was a mess when he was here with us, you know, and died at 26 or 27. You know, we knew those things, and we could see it, but I mean, there wasn't much we could do about it on a national level. You tend to react with what's close to home. You know, we didn't know when Sam was having his show in Washington. Local papers, I can assure you, didn't publish it. And so they had no way to know.
Mm-hmm.
And poor Sam was too busy trying to get his show up until he would have had time to tell us. And if he did, we were not in a position to have the money to buy a quick ticket and run up and stay in a hotel and go see it and then come back. So you did the best you could.
Mm-hmm.
When you went to town, instead of going to see a show, you called Sam, and I have his phone number. Said, "What's going on, babe?" And he says, "Come on down." And you get in the cab, you go down to the studio, and there it is, you know. And that's the way we would do it, you know. Kenneth Young, another friend of mine and a colleague of Sam, had a wonderful studio, and when I go to Washington, sometimes the courier would send me, because Gannett, who owned the courier, is based in the Washington area. I'd have some time, I'd call them, and you know, Ken would say, "Well, come on by, Mary. Let me meet you at such and such a place, and we'll have some drinks," and then we'd walk over back to his house where he lived and was his studio, and I'd see some of the things you were working on. But that's how you did it. It wasn't by no means a formal, no more formal than Picasso and his group had, Toulouse-Lautrec and his group had. It was never that much of a formal arrangement. If you happen to be frequenting the bar where I got my booze from, then you a good friend. That's just the way it is, you know. Nobody pays that much attention to locking in friendships that much. You knew each other. You also recognize that you got to do your thing and I got to do my thing. And but it was all right. It was all in good fun. And you pushed each other because all of us wanted to be on the cover of Art in America, you know. So. But it was cool when you think about it. I don't think it would change anything.
Mm-hmm.
Because you kept the competition going between artists. One wanting to be better than the other one. That was always there. And I don't know whether it was back in the days of Picasso and Rodin and all of those folks. They always wanted to be better, so it was no different. And the only difference was that we had limited spaces that we could show. And, you know, we had a zillion black churches, but nobody could afford the painting, you know. The places we wanted to show would be where people could afford to buy the paintings much the same way they bought the white paintings, which would allow us to get more supplies, more paints, more opportunities to show. And, you know, it balanced out. But when you think about it, one successful artist hasn't had to scrape and live as best they could with the skills they've got. They all, and I think that's part of it. We all were dirt poor. You just tried to do the best you can with what you got. And so, you know, sometimes when I didn't have enough paint, I mixed it with sand, you know. But, I mean, you see what I'm saying.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Did you all see your art as an opportunity to advance African Americans?
Oh, definitely. You see the world as we saw it, a segregated world, always put emphasis on what we can't do or be. And so we felt strongly it was not only right, but it was our duty to show what we could be ended. You see, so you, how, you could say this, that, and the other, but if I showed you a painting done, you can't say I didn't do it. And I'm trying to think. Maya Angelou has this wonderful poem she does, "And Still I Rise." And it suggests everything that the system has done to keep you down, and still I rise. If you ever get a chance to see a copy of it, it tells that story that in spite of all the difficulties, the good stuff comes to the top, you know, and mm-hmm. so that's basically what we had to do. You know, I learned a long time ago, and I learned it again when I asked Nelson Mandela, who I think is a hero, I said, "Weren't you angry that these people kept you in prison for 26 years? He said, "Merv, anger takes time. I don't have time for anger. I am trying to build a new nation where everybody in South Africa can be a part of." Made damn good sense to me. Don't have time to be angry. It takes too much energy. When I came back from meeting Mandela, I wrote a story about our meeting, and I used that to end the story, and it was appropriate, and it really was. But I also met that little lady up there, and her name is Nadine Gordimer. Nadine is from South Africa. She's from a Jewish family that fought for the rights of depressed people. But she's also a Nobel Prize winner in literature. She still lives. Oh, well, she doesn't now. She died last year. We're very good friends. I called her my good luck charm because I hate to fly. But every time she and I flew together, we both were doing work for the United Nations. Every time we got on a plane to fly together, she'd sit with me and I called her my good luck charm. Because she talked so much, I didn't have time to get scared. But she was fascinating. And the more you talked about her, you talked with her, the more you saw you had more things in common than you didn't. She was Jewish in South Africa, and I was African American in the United States. A lot of commonalities there, you know, and I became very close to her. We would go on trips because she and I were both advisors to the UNDP, which is the United Nations Development Programs, and we'd make these trips together. We must have made about 4 trips to Africa together. And I would sit with her because she would talk me to death. But she was special. And you just never know where you're going to find these people.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say, well, the only people I interact with are people that look like me. Mm-mm. That's impossible. Not if you get your head on right, because if you don't, you're missing something. You're missing the other points of view and help you to develop a point of view that is heavy and well thought out. So I need to hear all sides. And when you do, then you can reach your own conclusion.
Exactly.
What else can I tell you?
Did you see in Louisville a strong sense of a cultural advancement in the black community while you all...
Sure. We had artists we knew about. That whole group of artists, you mm-hmm. know. And they knew other people. We had musicians we knew about. We had places we went to entertain ourselves. That occasionally we would take a white friend with us and they would get a chance to see this whole thing. Going to one of my favorite spots called the Top Hat, which was a legendary place on Old Walnut Street, was something to behold. Because every black in town, it was one of the places where you could take your wife and nobody bothered you. One of the places that had singers like Dinah Washington and the major people singing. One of the places where you could sit at a table with your friends and nobody bothered you. You felt safe inside and outside. And that was cool.
Yeah. You kind of touched on this earlier, but as a whole, what themes did your all's art tend to portray? The stuff that you all were, you know, really putting out.
As many artists as they are, as many themes as they are. Sam Gilliam did abstract.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Douglas did representative.
Did they tend to be racially motivated? Were they related to, oppression?
We didn't just paint oppression. We painted pictures of our founders with children sitting on their laps. We painted pictures of our families. It wasn't just pictures of the brother being hung by a tree. We painted pictures of where we excelled. We painted pictures of how well we had done in spite of a community that didn't accept us.
Yeah.
And you couldn't take away from that. If you look at Jacob Lawrence, who is one of my favorites, and his pictures depict climbing Jacob's ladder, going to the top, his pictures depict exactly what I'm talking about. Whether they were abstract or realistic or somewhere in between, even the names suggested that we always had on our mind, success, perfect. We wanted things to be perfect, we wanted them to be as better than anybody else's. Why do you think we have so many basketball players that are great basketball players? They practice more. You find them in Shawnee Park and Jigsaw Park right now. That's what happened to artists. They practice more. The ones that made it were the ones that practiced more. You see what I'm saying?
So not only were you all painting to show what you could do, but even the themes of your paintings were directed at this, just being able to excel where people didn't think you could.
Not only that, being able to excel because we thought we could.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just for people. Sometimes we just did it for ourselves. And that was cool too. And when we would get together, oh boy, I was looking at some pictures just the other day of one of the art workshop shows, and we were all down in Fred's basement, you know, and we were looking at the pictures that were going to be in the show, and it was really cool. And so it became a world within a world, but isn't that how everything is? And we did this, and in the process we got married, we had children, we had jobs, because nobody was making a living just painting. And we were able to go to church and make sure our kids were in the right school, and we did all of that plus. And that says something about determination. That says something about wanting to make a change.
Did you see what you all were doing really influencing or, you know, affecting any younger generations?
Sure. As a matter of fact, we taught at the art workshop. We opened it up to the community, and so we had youngsters that would come and we would teach them art.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. I think I read it in Bob Douglas. He gave me a little short history essay kind of thing that he wrote.
Yeah.
I think he said something along the lines that you all also spent a lot of time discussing things, and not, you didn't just meet to show your work, but you...
Oh, no, we did. Look. Go back. Look at the big picture. Writers across the world get together and discuss writing. And we got together and discussed writing and art just like anybody else. We wanted to be intellectuals, too. We wanted to be able to hold a good conversation about what we thought was important. And so... we did. I mean, we would sit down in Fred's living room, Bob's basement, or my living room, and talk till 2-3 o'clock in the morning about what was important to us in the area of art. You know, and it would be really cool. I mean, you know, I'd go to bed feeling really good, because we had a chance to discuss it. If you don't do art, or you don't do writing, you can't discuss it. Mm-hmm. You don't have any examples, but somebody else's. This puts you in a situation where you had to put up or shut up. And there were a lot of folks who just came and sat around and listened. It's interesting.
I know you were involved in the civil rights movement pretty substantially, both personally and professionally. Did you see your involvement in that informing your art?
Mm-hmm. It's a part of me.
Mm-hmm.
But none of the folks you talked about participated in that.
Yeah.
I was the only one that got arrested. I was the one on 4th Street that they put in the paddy wagon. As a matter of fact, if you look in my book, you'll see a picture of me getting put in the paddy wagon.
I think I've seen that one.
Yeah. I tell you, some of my buddies, I said, look, if as many people as said they were there, we'd have no room to walk on the sidewalks. In actuality, there were 10 to 15 solid folks that we could depend on that would be out there marching with us. And those are the folks that got arrested time and time again. And those are the folks that Mrs. Bix, who owned Bix clothing store, and Ziegarts, who owned a drugstore down in the West End, these are the folks who would come and get us out. And a few doctors, a few black doctors like Dr. Rabb and what have you. These are folks that came to us out. We didn't say, don't let Mr. Ziegart pay my fine and get me out, because my wife or my mother or my sister or brother was scared to death that somebody would hurt us while we were in there.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they did try. Sometimes when you would get arrested, not only here, but I'm talking about in Mississippi and Alabama, where I did some more marching, and they would arrest you, they would go through every back road they could to scare you to death. Sometimes you said, I am not going to ever get to the jail because they're going to string me up before I get there. That is not a good feeling. And there's no damn thing you can do about it. But on the other hand, it gave me another story to tell you, you see. And now you say, well, how in the hell did you do that? We did that because we knew we had to make some sacrifices. And for every black that was hung by vigilantes, there were five that were hung and nobody found them. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And it got scary out there. I remember coming back, you remember the march on Montgomery that King led?
Mm-hmm.
I remember coming back from that march, thousands of people that showed up, they marched across the bridge. If you saw Selma,
mm-hmm.
you saw it. I got a great picture I'll show you before you leave. Of me in that march, crossing the bridge, and going into Montgomery. There were oodles of people there. But on our way back, we were all going back to hometowns. And I looked out the back of the car. My friend Elma, thank goodness, was driving. And Frank and I had rented a car rather than take our own. And there were these guys waving their pistols at us as they followed us. And for about 10 minutes, which felt like 10 hours,
mm-hmm.
I told my friend Yama, put the pedal to the metal. And he did, and boy, we were hitting them curves. It wasn't until we saw the Tennessee state sign that says, "Welcome to Tennessee," that we felt relief and they stopped and didn't go across there. You know what that feels like?
Oh.
And you live to tell about it.
Mm-hmm.
All we wanted to do was pull in the first drive-in we saw and stop and catch our breath and have a cup of coffee, because while all this was going on, my job was to do an inventory to see what we had to protect ourselves. Well, hell, we had one empty Coke bottle. I think about that all the time. I was losing my mind. But, again, it's a story I can tell my grandchildren, and mm-hmm. they can tell their grandchildren. So, as I get older, I don't worry much about what's coming, because I did the best I could with what I had, and if it was art, I did the best I could, at least got a chance. I had oil paints, watercolors, paintbrushes. I still got vases back in my studio, vases and brushes that big, you know. So got it all, and yesterday I was working on a painting, and I'm going to work on a painting tonight. So I'm still doing my thing, you know, and that's fine. That's fine. Art to me is a relaxer. It's like having an aspirin when you have a headache. It's my way. Nobody's going to spank me on the hands if they don't like the stroke I made. And since there's nobody in that room, I got a little sign that says, "Private." Even my wife doesn't go in there much. But, no, art has meant an awful lot. Because it's a form of self-expression.
Mm-hmm.
If I was a musician, it would be, how many songs did you compose? Did you always play everybody else's? As an artist, it's, did you do some pictures to reflect how you felt about the world we live in? Yeah. And I met other people who told me what they were doing, and they were all different. And so you end up with a book of stories. I know I've just talked you to death today.
Oh, there's, I enjoy it, believe me. Just one final kind of all-encompassing question. Kind of how, especially in you know, the 60s, how important was culture to the black community? And did some people kind of tend to put more emphasis on, you know, the African culture or the culture of the African American?
I think it's both. I think it was as important as whites put on the culture they got from European countries. I came to be sure that this country too. And so we weren't the only one doing this, is what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. The Italians came and they brought with them their food and culture and dress and what have you. So it was important. But we as African Americans have always wanted to be a part of rather than apart from.
Mm-hmm.
And we've always figured that to be a part of, you have to accept me and the gifts I bring. So that's how you can truly be a part of America, if you're able to accept me as a person and the gifts I bring, because it may be I cook the best barbecue in town. That's a gift. I may not, but it may well be, you know, that I've got this other gift. I make the best birdhouses in town. You know, you're not going to know unless you open up and accept me as a package. And I think that would make America what it is. That more often than not these days, we accept the whole package. And sometimes, after we open all the big boxes, we get to a little box, no bigger than that, and we find the biggest surprise in there. A key to finding more boxes. And you see, you got to be an optimist in order to live a productive life. You can't always be complaining. I know people who don't know how to do anything else but complain. Sometimes I tell my wife, you like that. But you got to be able to put it in context. You got to look at the good with the bad. And sometimes, I hate coffee without sugar. But once I put 2 spoons of sugar in it, I'm fine. And that's how life is. You may hate this situation, but you've got the sugar pot. Now, get involved and put 2 spoons of sugar in there, and it's something both of you can enjoy. You see where I'm coming from.
Of course.
And that's why I enjoy having young people come over and just sit around and talk. I sit out there on the swing, and young folks come by. I'm talking about folks your age come by and sit on that swing, and we talk for hours about anything and everything. That's cool, because I need to know what they're thinking about, and they need to know what I thought about, you know, so that's fun. What else can I tell you?
I think that about covers it. I think that's about it.